In a world in which movies struggle to find plot, Alan Adams of The Main Edge breaks it down for you in Pass the Popcorn. Now on Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Let's all go to the lobby.
It is time to talk movies. Alan Adams of The Main Edge joins us for Pass the Popcorn. Hello there, Alan.
Hello, sir. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. How is your Monday so far?
Oh, it's going all right. A bit busy, but good.
And you were a busy guy this weekend checking out different films. Four of them? Is that right? Did I see four? Wow. Well, let's get right to it. Where do you want to begin?
We got a couple that we can just get out of the way. So let's just, we'll do that to start. We'll start with a movie called Godmothered, which is it's a Disney original. It's currently streaming on Disney Plus. It is, you know how sometimes you just want a movie that everyone in your family can watch without actively complaining?
Yes.
That's kind of what this movie is. It's the story of a wannabe fairy godmother who ventures into the real world in hopes of helping someone find their happily ever after. If this sounds familiar to you, it's because Disney has made this exact movie about 100 times. it's the kind of stuff we've sort of come to expect from the live action side of Disney, you know, not the sort of the non-IP edition.
Right.
And it's executed with the same sort of efficient competence that we expect from Disney. And look, adhering to in-house rubrics and general formula is never going to result in a great movie. What it will get you is a decent movie, and that's kind of what this is. The direction is workmanlike, the script is vanilla. It's a movie that's a perfectly nice time, and that you will never need to watch or think about ever again. the basic gist: we're in a place called the Motherland, which is the home to all the world's fairy godmothers, but things are in decline. It's been years since their magic was used to help people in the real world, and we have Eleanor, played by Jillian Bell, who is a fairy godmother in training. In fact, the only fairy godmother in training, because the aforementioned decline in their services out there in the world. Things are so bad that the headmistress of the godmother school, played by Jane Curtin, who's, you know, wonderful, she's going to shut it all down, and all the current fairy godmothers are going to become tooth fairies. Like, that's what's happening. So Eleanor refuses to give up on the dream and figures if she could just execute one assignment and help someone find their happily ever after, things could stay the same. So she heads to the records room and finds this letter, this unanswered letter from a young girl in Boston named Mackenzie, who looks like a good possibility. So Eleanor opens a portal to the real world, makes her way to Boston to help this little girl and help her find her happiness. Unfortunately, the letter's a little older than anticipated. Mackenzie is no longer 10. She is 40 years old, played by Isla Fisher. She's a single mom of two and is a field producer for the fifth place TV news show in Boston. The initial reaction, as you might imagine, is to consider her a crazy person. But then the magic comes out, convinces Mac that she's the real deal. She meets the daughters and it starts to get a sense of just how far removed from happily ever after we are. And then, well, it kind of plays out the way you would expect it to. Turns out that Mac has a coworker whose name is literally Hugh Prince. I can't stress that enough. This is the sort of movie we're talking about. The Prince Charming, his last name is literally Prince. But happily ever after, not that easy. The clock is ticking. She needs to figure out what's happening. Blah-de-blah-de-blah. It's fine. The movie's fine. It's the sort of movie that... parents could feel comfortable putting on for their kids and then leaving the room for 2 hours. Like, it's that sort of thing. Like, there's some funny gags or whatever, but it's just, you know, it's sometimes you just want a movie that no one's going to actively dislike.
Right.
And you don't need to worry about seeing something inappropriate. And this movie's got a sweet story. The kids are cute. The gags are okay. You might want a little more magic from a movie like this, but I mean, it's a relatively gentle thing. I refer to it as a Nilla wafer of a movie. It goes down easy, and it's gentle enough for even the most sensitive constitutions.
All right, now that's number one. What else was forgettable, perhaps, this weekend?
Well, I don't even know if this one is forgettable. It's definitely, I'm never going to forget it, but maybe not for the right reasons. So there's this movie called Love, Weddings, and Other Disasters. It is, the way I put it was, like, there are some movies that are just watchable. Like, there are movies you just can't tear your eyes away from. And most of the time, that's because, you know, it's a really incredibly made movie. It's a combination of narrative and aesthetic excellence, and it just really, you know, demands to be experienced. But sometimes you have a movie that's compulsively watchable because it's the opposite of all that. Like, it's just an absolute, utter mess that you just, you know, that just demands to be rubbernecked. And that's what this movie is. Love, Weddings, and Other Disasters is an aptly titled film, because there's a lot of disaster going on in this movie. It's written and directed by a frequent Adam Sandler collaborator, Dennis Dugan. It's an attempt to walk the sort of well-worn path of intersecting storyline rom-coms. I basically refer to it as, Love Actually with a head injury and a lack of understanding regarding humor or basic human relationships. Like, that's basically what this movie is. There's a woman named Jessie who we meet when she's jumping out of an airplane with her boyfriend. They break up in the air as they're plunging to Earth. She winds up crashing into a wedding party that's having a dockside wedding, which leads to viral video fame, and she is known as the wedding trasher. Then we have this guy, Lawrence, played by Jeremy Irons, who I have no idea how he wound up here. He's New York City's most famous wedding caterer. He's devoted utterly to his craft at the expense of all else. His wife passed away some years ago, but he's got some friends who want to set him up on a blind date with Sarah, who's played by Diane Keaton. And when I say blind date, I mean a literal blind date, Rich, because she can't see. In case you were wondering what kind of movie we're dealing with, this is what we're talking about. And then we have a guy, Captain Richie, who leads a historically inaccurate duck boat tour. One day on one of his tours, he encounters a beautiful woman who he instantly falls in love with. And Rich, I swear to God, she has a glass slipper tattooed on her neck. Like, there's nothing subtle about this movie. Anyway, so we have a mayoral candidate who's getting married. He's concerned with his image, but his free-spirited bride-to-be doesn't really care. So she decides to hire the skydiver as her wedding planner, despite the fact that she's not actually a wedding planner, because she went to Jesse's cousin's wedding and thought it was good. The mayor's brother is on a reality dating show that involves being chained to a Russian woman named Svetlana, who was probably not entirely truthful during the vetting process. And there's a side plot where there's a bar band they're trying to get them to play the wedding, but they're having some internal conflict, including a pretty on the nose Yoko Ono situation. I think that's it. Do you get it all?
Oh yeah, I think stuff? So. Yeah.
Okay. None of it makes any sense, Rich. The quality of the connections varies wildly. Like, it goes from thin to non-existent. Like, it all comes together more or less in an ending that is almost but not quite as ineffective as everything that came before it. Like, it really is an aptly titled movie, because it is it's a disaster. Like, at best, it's hard to follow. At worst, it borders on nonsensical. Like, it's the sort of movie where multiple times I actually said aloud things like, "What is happening?" And this doesn't make any sense. Thank goodness I'm watching at home, because otherwise I would have, like, someone would have asked me to leave. But, you know, I say all that, but Rich, I actually really enjoyed myself while I was watching this movie. Like, it's not good, it's bad. It is actively bad. But I found the badness watchable. Like, each moment promised the possibility of, like, another clunky line or a humorless joke or an absurd plot point. And for whatever reason, I was in the right headspace for it when I saw it. Sometimes, man, you just want to watch the world burn. when we have a magnificent mess like this, like something that's teetering on the edge of utter incomprehensibility at any moment, you're just left there to just question the judgment of everyone involved. So utterly does it misfire. But like I said, you know, sometimes you just want to embrace the chaos.
There you go. We're talking with Alan Adams of The Main Edge. here on Pass the Popcorn on Downtown. What's next?
Okay, now we're getting into the good stuff.
Okay.
So I watched this. I'd only recently heard about this movie, Sound of Metal. It's currently streaming on Amazon Prime Video. It's a debut feature from a director, written and directed by a guy named Darius Marder. And it's this. It's the story of a heavy metal drummer who has to deal with the unexpected and rapid deterioration of his hearing. He's a former addict, so it sort of pushes him towards this towards potential relapse. Like, it's this incredible, like, very powerful exploration of what it means to lose the thing that we think defines us, and the sorts of things that we might do to regain that definition. Like, it looks at what it means to need help, but not necessarily be willing to accept that help. And you've got this absolutely incandescent lead performance from Riz Ahmed. One of the most innovative sound designs I've encountered in a movie in a very long time. You put those two things together, it just lands so hard. Okay, so we've got this guy, Ruben. He's the drummer for a rock duo called... the hilariously named Black Gammon, which is a fantastic name for a band, alongside his sort of the lead singer slash guitarist slash girlfriend, Lou, played by Olivia Cooke. Like, they're in the midst of their first serious tour. They're crossing the country in their RV. They're playing club shows. And early on, it seems like things are going really well. Like, the shows are well attended. The merch sales are robust. Plus, they're spending a lot of time together, but it's only enhancing their relationship, giving them these opportunities to enjoy one another. But then it starts to change. Like, at first, it's barely noticeable. There's a ringing or a buzzing sound in Ruben's ears. But very quickly, it becomes, like, impossible to ignore. Like, his hearing's cutting out almost completely. Like he's underwater, like, barely able to discern sounds from one another. And he initially tries to play through it. But, you know, as you might imagine, not being able to hear is problematic for a musician. So he seeks out medical advice, only to be told that it's degenerative and extremely fast-moving. The advice he gets is to avoid loud sounds, which Ruben promptly ignores and continues to play. He finally confesses to Lou. Her immediate concern is for his health, like, you know, his physical health, yes, but the emotional health. You know, he's a recovering heroin addict. He's 4 years clean, but, you know, that temptation never goes. And with the turn this tragic, she's worried that he might succumb, and so she reaches out to his sponsor to get help. He winds up landing at an addiction treatment facility aimed specifically at the deaf, where he meets this guy, Joe, played by Paul Rassi, who's an alcoholic who lost his hearing in an explosion in Vietnam. And Ruben resists, starts adjusting to this new home and the circumstances. But even then, he's sort of continuing to investigate surgical options in order to treat his hearing loss. But that inability to come to terms with his situation leads to even more obstacles. And, you know, his future depends not on whether he regains the ability to hear, but rather whether he can learn how to listen. And it's, you know, it's this really thoughtful sort of portrait of that sort of redefinition, like capturing the pain that comes with realizing that your life as you knew it has changed and may never return to what it was. Like, it's angry and it's painful. And like, even the individual moments, even the individual highs are sort of undercut by these constant lows. Just as a character study, it's compelling. But the sound design, like, what they've done is they've found ways to sort of to allow us to hear what Ruben hears as his hearing deteriorates. So we get to hear the ringing and the buzzing, and we get to hear what these voices sound like through that the muffled sort of underwater feeling, and we get a sense of the silence as well, like the inability to hear any of it. And we balance that with various devices. Sign language enters into it, as well as some sort of transcription, like software type things. But it's really effective. Like, it really brings forward the impact of that change, and we get this sort of almost real time journey through the deterioration, which gives an added depth to the story that was already engaging. You know, it's interesting because I'm not a sound guy, so I don't necessarily notice sound design so specifically, but like, you can't help but do it here because it's just so present. And again, it all works because Riz Ahmed is just brilliant. Like, he is brilliant in this movie, from like rock star cool, tough guy pretensions, and then you get the sort of veneer cracks where you see the fear and the vulnerability. Like, he's just incredible. It's like a raw, real energy, that sort of pain balanced by a sort of wry nihilism, you know, punk rock kind of vibe. Also, I buy him as a drummer too, which, you know, that's no small thing when you watch musicians play music on screen. Like, you could tell when they don't know what they're doing, and this dude knows what he's doing. The supporting turns are solid as well. There are some good performances, but really, it's all about what we get from him, and we get a lot. Like, not a feel-good movie. It gets pretty bleak and can be a tough watch, but I gotta say, like, it's really, it's worth the effort, because it really is a phenomenal experience.
All right, and finally, let's wrap it up with a film that's generating a lot of discussion and mostly favorable reviews. I'm curious to hear your take on Mank.
I loved this movie. I'm in the bag for David Fincher anyway. So I was always going to be predisposed to enjoying this movie. It's interesting. Like, we hear the term like movie magic pretty regularly. And it's, you know, the intent, I think, is to evoke that sense of awe and wonder that comes from the big screen. But, you know, there's a darkness that can come with magic, and, you know, that darkness can be rendered much even more deeply through the sort of flickering light of the projector. And this is a movie that is about that darkness, I think, in a lot of ways, that really explores sort of the kind of bleak underside of the rapid rise of early Hollywood. Like I said, David Fincher directs. The screenplay was written by his late father, Jack Fincher. It's a project that's been in the offing. My understanding is it's been in the offing since like the late 90s. Like, I guess this was Fincher's initial hope, was that this would be the follow-up to The Game, which I think came out in like 1997. But it's ostensibly the story of Herman Mankiewicz, the writer or co-writer, depending on how much stock you put into like early 70s Pauline Kael of Citizen Kane. But that's kind of the tip of the iceberg. Like, it's an ode to old Hollywood, but not the kind of self-celebration we usually get from stories set in this time and place. Like, instead, it's like we get a look at the real sort of unseemly sleaziness that was so just utterly shot through the industry. Tyrannical studio heads and other assorted titans, like Freely, and just taking advantage of those with even a modicum less power than what they possess. And, you know, it's a story of a man's journey from respectability to sellout to burnout to oddly noble flame out, like, all kind of set against the backdrop of this time that has been so cynically romanticized by an industry that loves nothing more than patting itself on the back. I'm not going to try to go into the specifics as far as plot is concerned. You know, just know that, you know, we basically go back and forth. We spend a significant amount of our time watching a sort of bedridden, or practically bedridden, Mank working on the first draft of the script for what would become Citizen Kane at behest of Orson Welles, who's played by a guy named Tom Burke, who I'd never seen before, but I thought was quite good.
Mm.
But anyway, everyone's sort of like, and he's got like a babysitter, like John Houseman, played by Sam Troughton. He's got a secretary / stenographer named Rita, played by Lily Collins, and all these people are devoted to sort of pushing and cajoling and imploring him to complete the script. But it really comes forward in the flashbacks, where we kind of move back in time and we get a sense of sort of Mank's journey up through the echelons of Hollywood, from, you know, early story meetings to, you know, him sort of running in the circles with like the real studio legends, like Louis B. Mayer, Irving Thalberg, David O. Selznick, like all these guys. And then we get a sense of his friendship with Marion Davies, who is played by Amanda Seyfried, who I thought was phenomenal in this. And that in turn leads to his entry into the orbit of one William Randolph Hearst, who was played by Charles Dance, because of course he was played by Charles Dance. I don't know who else you would get to play William Randolph Hearst for a movie like this. And Mank kind of slides into this sort of court jester role. Like, he's, you know, quick with a quick with a sort of witticism, and he's willing to speak truth to power, you know, kind of unafraid to bite the hands that feed him. But, you know, that's a tendency that only works until it doesn't, and it sort of ultimately proves to be his undoing. And we move back and forth from the sort of sweaty quietude of screenwriting to the sort of ever-increasing scale of his involvement with and understanding of the movie business. And then, you know, there are a couple of turns that I don't want to spill on just because I feel like I didn't see them coming, and I feel like my experience was enhanced because of that. So I'm not going to go into too much detail about that. But ultimately, it was just such a stunning stylistic achievement for me. Like, in terms of the technical execution, I just thought it was so beautifully done. Like, just wonderful touches contribute to this feeling of doubling, like a movie that exists both in the past and in the present. I thought Fincher did a great job of capturing the period vibe, not just in content, but in terms of like execution. Like, there were some wide shots where it's like it literally looked like you were looking at like a painted backdrop, even though you were in like a real place, you know, and stuff like the manufactured cigarette burns to mark the real changes, like real, like big things, small things, all intended to sort of capture, evoke the vibe of the time. And it was all about reflecting the film that served as its inspiration, because, you know, there are a lot of moments that mirror Citizen Kane in this film. You know, and Fincher's always been just a wonderful visual stylist, and I think this is as full a realization of those gifts as we've seen. I thought there was a very, very screwball comedy vibe to the dialogue, like very rapid fire staccato kind of quality. I thought the score was great. Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross are frequent collaborators with Fincher, and I thought they found the sweet spot as far as finding stuff that was both inside and outside the moment. That said, again, and I can't stress enough, I love this movie. It's not really about the question of authorship, which is something that I expected going in. Like, I thought it was going to be much more about sort of a relitigation of the Mankiewicz-Welles dichotomy as far as the crafting of the screenplay. And if anything, I think it's pretty clear in a lot of senses that the story is probably more fiction than fact.
Yes.
and it's much more interested in sort of unpacking the environment into which Citizen Kane was birthed rather than the origins of the film itself, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Well, having seen it, it does, yes.
You know, one of my maybe problems it's not the right word, but I would have loved to see someone more age appropriate play Mank.
Well, and that's,
not that I don't love Gary Oldman.
And that's what bothered me a lot, is that he's great. He's a tremendous actor, but just way too old to play that part in that time period.
You know what I mean? And it was just like, you know, and again, they do everything they can to make it work. Like Oldman has a real knack for a sort of lived in world weariness, and that goes some distance to compensating for his age. The black and white palette helps. You know, Fincher is really good at putting him in positions where it's not necessarily as obvious. And he has a real gift for sort of sliding from background to foreground and back again. But, you know, you're just left to wonder. Again, I think he's great. I think Oldman, and I think he's great in this. But I'm left to wonder what a more age-appropriate casting might have added to this movie. Like, I get why you want Gary Oldman, because he's freaking Gary Oldman, you know what I mean? But I just, you know, you wonder what someone who was actually, you know, they even play it for a joke at one point where, you know, they say, you're too old for this. And he's like, what, I'm 43. All right. And it's like, really, Gary? Really? but that being said, there are some other phenomenal performances. Like I said, Amanda Seyfried is great. Like, she really sort of captures that vibe of, you know, concealing who you are behind a, you know, sort of blonde airheadedness as sort of protection. You know, Charles Dance as William Randolph Hearst was just a delight. You know, guys like Arliss Howard and Frederick Kingsley are great as, you know, Louis B. Mayer. Like, there's a great walk and talk sequence with Louis B. Mayer as they sort of walk through the the Warner Brothers lot or the MGM lot, and they just really because so many movies from that period have that kind of walk through the lot moment, and to see that sort of brought back and sort of reinvestigated and sort of recontextualized was really interesting. I love Lily Collins. She gets lost in the shuffle. I heard a great story about the guy, Tom Burke, who played Orson Welles, who I thought did a great job of capturing the sort of vocal quality and that weird sort of smooth charisma that young Orson Welles had. But it's a great story. Apparently, Fincher put him in touch with the voice actor Maurice LaMarche, who is, among other things, the voice of the Brain in the Pinky and the Brain cartoons. because I guess, and this is from what I understand, Fincher was basically like, no one understands how Orson Welles breathed like Maurice LaMarche. And you hear that and it's like, oh, because that totally makes sense, because it is such a unique sort of breathy cadence. And I thought it was really well realized. Like, ultimately, like, most of the time, movies telling stories from this period treat the era as a golden age of sorts, and it was. But this isn't that movie. Like, although I will say, you could argue that Mank does in fact serve as a love letter to Hollywood, just not the kind we're accustomed to seeing. It's the more toxic sort of love, like the kind of unhealthy, obsessive romance that too often ends in tears and pain. And, that's how this one ends.
Excellent. All right. Alan Adams summing it all up for us this afternoon. Now, we thank you as always. Have a good couple of days, and let's say we get together on Wednesday.
Works for me. We'll talk then.
Thanks, Alan.